of both sexes to a state of servitude, with roasting alive 7 of the principal citizens, with drowning 20 in the sea, and with reserving 42 in chains to receive their doom from the mouth of the emperor. In their return, the fleet was driven on the rocky shores of Anatolia. Then Justinian applauded the obedience of the Black Sea, which had involved so many thousands of his subjects and enemies in a common shipwreck. But the tyrant was still insatiate of blood, and a second expedition was commanded to extirpate the remains of the proscribed colony. In the short interval, the Chersonites had returned to their city and were prepared to die in arms. The Khan of the Khazars had renounced the cause of his odious brother. The exiles of every province were assembled in Taurus, and Bardanes, under the name of Philippicus, was invested with the purple. The imperial troops, unwilling and unable to perpetrate the revenge of Justinian, escaped his displeasure by abjuring his allegiance. The fleet, under their new sovereign, steered back a more auspicious course to the harbours of Sinope and Constantinople, and every tongue was prompt to pronounce, every hand to execute, the death of the tyrant. Destitute of friends, he was deserted by his barbarian guards, and the stroke of the assassin was praised as an act of patriotism and Roman virtue. His son Tiberius had taken refuge in a church. His aged grandmother guarded the door, and the innocent youth, suspending round his neck the most formidable relics, embraced with one hand the altar, with the other the wood of the true cross. But the popular fury that dares to trample on superstition is deaf to the cries of humanity, and the race of Heraclius was extinguished after a reign of 100 years. Between the fall of the Heraclian and the rise of the Isaurian dynasty, a short interval of 6 years is divided into 3 reigns. Bardanes, or Philippicus, was hailed at Constantinople as a hero who had delivered his country from a tyrant, and he might taste some moments of happiness in the first transports of sincere and universal joy. Justinian had left behind him an ample treasure, the fruit of cruelty and rapine. But this useful fund was soon and idly dissipated by his successor. On the festival of his birthday, Philippicus entertained the multitude with the games of the hippodrome. From thence he paraded through the streets with 1,000 banners and 1,000 trumpets, refreshed himself in the baths of Zeuxippus, and, returning to the palace, entertained his nobles with a sumptuous banquet. At the meridian hour he withdrew to his chamber, intoxicated with flattery and wine, and forgetful that his example had made every subject ambitious, and that every ambitious subject was his secret enemy. Some bold conspirators introduced themselves in the disorder of the feast, and the slumbering monarch was surprised, bound, blinded, and deposed, before he was sensible of his danger. Yet the traitors were deprived of their reward, and the free voice of the Senate and people promoted Artemius from the office of secretary to that of emperor. He assumed the title of Anastasius II, and displayed in a short and troubled reign the virtues both of peace and war. But after the extinction of the imperial line, the rule of obedience was violated, and every change diffused the seeds of new revolutions. In a mutiny of the fleet, an obscure and reluctant officer of the revenue was forcibly invested with the purple. After some months of a naval war, Anastasius resigned the scepter, and the conqueror, Theodosius III, submitted in his turn to the superior ascendant of Leo, the general and emperor of the Oriental troops. His two predecessors were permitted to embrace the ecclesiastical profession. The restless impatience of Anastasius tempted him to risk and to lose his life in a treasonable enterprise. But the last days of Theodosius were honorable and secure. The single sublime word, health, which he inscribed on his tomb, expresses the confidence of philosophy or religion, then the fame of his miracles was long preserved among the people of Ephesus. This convenient shelter of the church might sometimes impose a lesson of clemency, but it may be questioned whether it is for the public interest to diminish the perils of unsuccessful ambition. I have dwelt on the fall of a tyrant. I shall briefly represent the founder of a new dynasty, who is known to posterity by the invectives of his enemies, and whose public and private life is involved in the ecclesiastical story of the iconoclasts. Yet in spite of the clamors of superstition, a favorable prejudice for the character of Leo the Isaurian may be reasonably drawn from the obscurity of his birth and the duration of his reign. In an age of manly spirit, the prospect of an imperial reward would have kindled every energy of the mind and produced a crowd of competitors as deserving as they were desirous to reign. Even in the corruption and debility of the modern Greeks, the elevation of a plebeian from the last to the first rank of society supposes some qualifications above the level of the multitude. He would probably be ignorant and disdainful of speculative science, and in the pursuit of fortune, he might absolve himself from the obligations of benevolence and justice. But to his character we may ascribe the useful virtues of prudence and fortitude, the knowledge of mankind, and the important art of gaining their confidence and directing their passions. It is agreed that Leo was a native of Isauria, and that Conon was his primitive name. The writers, whose awkward satire is praise, describe him as an itinerant peddler, who drove an ass with some paltry merchandise to the country fairs, and foolishly relate that he met on the road some Jewish fortune-tellers who promised him the Roman Empire on condition that he should abolish the worship of idols. A more probable account relates the migration of his father from Asia Minor to Thrace, where he exercised the lucrative trade of a grazier. And he must have acquired considerable wealth, since the first introduction of his son was procured by a supply of 500 sheep to the imperial camp. His first service was in the guards of Justinian, where he soon attracted the notice, and by degrees, the jealousy of the tyrant. His valor and dexterity were conspicuous in the Colchian War. From Anastasius he received the command of the Anatolian legions, and by the suffrage of the soldiers he was raised to the empire with the general applause of the Roman world. In this dangerous elevation, Leo III supported himself against the envy of his equals, the discontent of a powerful faction, and the assaults of his foreign and domestic enemies. The Catholics, who accuse his religious innovations, are obliged to confess that they were undertaken with temper and conducted with firmness. Their silence respects the wisdom of his administration and the purity of his manners. After a reign of 24 years, he peaceably expired in the palace of Constantinople, and the purple which he had acquired was transmitted by the right of inheritance to the third generation. In a long reign of 34 years, the son and successor of Leo, Constantine V, surnamed Copronymus, attacked with less temperate zeal the images or idols of the church. Their votaries have exhausted the bitterness of religious gall in their portrait of this spotted panther, this antichrist, this flying dragon of the serpent's seed, who surpassed the vices of Elagabalus and Nero. His reign was a long butchery of whatever was most noble or holy or innocent in his empire. In person, the emperor assisted at the execution of his victims, surveyed their agonies, listened to their groans, and indulged, without satiating, his appetite for blood. A plate of noses was accepted as a grateful offering, and his domestics were often scourged or mutilated by the royal hand. His surname was derived from his pollution of his baptismal font. The infant might be excused, but the manly pleasures of Copronymus degraded him below the level of a brute. His lust confounded the eternal distinctions of sex and species, and he seemed to extract some unnatural delight from the objects most offensive to human sense. In his religion, the iconoclast was a heretic, a Jew, a Mohammedan, a pagan, and an atheist. And his belief of an invisible power could be discovered only in his magic rites, human victims, and nocturnal sacrifices to Venus of the demons of antiquity. His life was stained with the most opposite vices, and the ulcers which covered his body anticipated before his death the sentiment of hell tortures. Of these accusations, which I have so patiently copied, a part is refuted by its own absurdity, and in the private anecdotes of the life of the princes, the lie is more easy as the detection is more difficult. Without adopting the pernicious maxim that where much is alleged, something must be true, I can, however, discern that Constantine V was dissolute and cruel. Calumny is more prone to exaggerate than to invent, and her licentious tongue is checked in some measure by the experience of the age and country to which she appeals. Of the bishops and monks, the generals and magistrates who are said to have suffered under his reign, the numbers are recorded, the names were conspicuous, the execution was public, the mutilation visible and permanent. The Catholics hated the person and government of Copronymus, but even their hatred is a proof of their oppression. They dissembled the provocations which might excuse or justify his rigor, but even these provocations must gradually inflame his resentment and harden his temper in the use or the abuse of despotism. Yet the character of the fifth Constantine was not devoid of merit, nor did his government always deserve the curses or the contempt of the Greeks. From the confession of his enemies I am informed of the restoration of an ancient aqueduct, of the redemption of 2,500 captives, of the uncommon plenty of the times, and of the new colonies with which he repeopled Constantinople and the Thracian cities. They reluctantly praise his activity and courage. He was on horseback in the field at the head of his legions, and although the fortune of his arms was various, he triumphed by sea and land on the Euphrates and the Danube, in civil and barbarian war. Heretical praise must be cast into the scale to counterbalance the weight of orthodox invective. The iconoclasts revered the virtues of the prince. 40 years after his death they still prayed before the tomb of the saint. A miraculous vision was propagated by fanaticism or fraud, and the Christian hero appeared on a milk-white steed, brandishing his lance against the pagans of Bulgaria. An absurd fable, says the Catholic historian, since Copronymus is chained with the demons in the abyss of hell. Leo IV, the son of the fifth and the father of the sixth Constantine, was of a feeble constitution both of mind and body, and the principal care of his reign was the settlement of the succession. The association of the young Constantine was urged by the officious zeal of his subjects, and the emperor, conscious of his decay, complied, after a prudent hesitation, with their unanimous wishes. The royal infant at the age of 5 years was crowned with his mother Irene, and the national consent was ratified by every circumstance of pomp and solemnity that could dazzle the eyes or blind the conscience of the Greeks. An oath of fidelity was administered in the palace, the church, and the hippodrome to the several orders of the state, who adjured the holy names of the Son and Mother of God. Be witness, O Christ, that we will watch over the safety of Constantine, the son of Leo, expose our lives in his service, and bear true allegiance to his person and posterity. They pledged their faith on the wood of the true cross, and the act of their engagement was deposited on the altar of Santa Sophia. The first to swear and the first to violate their oath were the five sons of Capronymus by second marriage, and the story of these princes is singular and tragic. The right of primogeniture excluded them from the throne. The injustice of their elder brother defrauded them of a legacy of about 2 millions sterling. Some vain titles were not deemed a sufficient compensation for wealth and power, and they repeatedly conspired against their nephew before and after the death of his father. Their first attempt was pardoned. For the second offence, they were condemned to the ecclesiastical state. And for the third treason, Nicephorus, the eldest and most guilty, was deprived of his eyes. And his four brothers, Christopher, Nicetas, Anthemius, and Eudoxus, were punished as a milder sentence by the amputation of their tongues. After 5 years' confinement, they escaped to the church of Santa Sophia, and displayed a pathetic spectacle to the people. "Countrymen and Christians," cried Nicephorus for himself and his mute brethren, "behold the sons of your emperor, if you can still recognize our features in this miserable state. A life, an imperfect life, is all that the malice of our enemies has spared. It is now threatened, and we now throw ourselves on your compassion." The rising murmur might have produced a revolution had it not been checked by the presence of a minister who soothed the unhappy princes with flattery and hope and gently drew them from the sanctuary to the palace. They were speedily embarked for Greece, and Athens was allotted for the place of their exile. In this calm retreat and in their helpless condition, Nicephorus and his brothers were tormented by the thirst of power, and tempted by a Sclavonian chief who offered to break their prison and to lead them in arms, and in the purple, to the gates of Constantinople. But the Athenian people, ever zealous in the cause of Irene, prevented her justice or cruelty, and the five sons of Capronymus were plunged in eternal darkness and oblivion. For himself, that emperor had chosen a barbarian wife, the daughter of the Khan of the Khozars. But in the marriage of his heir, he preferred an Athenian virgin, an orphan, 17 years old, whose sole fortune must have consisted in her personal accomplishments. The nuptials of Leo and Irene were celebrated with royal pomp. She soon acquired the love and confidence of a feeble husband, and in his testament he declared the empress guardian of the Roman world and of their son Constantine the VI, who was no more than 10 years of age. During his childhood, Irene most ably and assiduously discharged in her public administration the duties of a faithful mother, and her zeal in the restoration of images has deserved the name and honors of a saint, which she still occupies in the Greek calendar. But the emperor attained the maturity of youth. The maternal yoke became more grievous, and he listened to the favorites of his own age, who shared his pleasures, and were ambitious of sharing his power. Their reasons convinced him of his right, their praises of his ability to reign, and he consented to reward the services of Irene by a perpetual banishment to the Isle of Sicily. But her vigilance and penetration easily disconcerted their rash projects. A similar or more severe punishment was retaliated on themselves and their advisers, and Irene inflicted on the ungrateful prince the chastisement of a boy. After this contest, the mother and the son were at the head of 2 domestic factions, and instead of mild influence and voluntary obedience, she held in chains a captive and an enemy. The empress was overthrown by the abuse of victory. The oath of fidelity, which she exacted to herself alone, was pronounced with reluctant murmurs, and the bold refusal of the Armenian guards encouraged a free and general declaration that Constantine the VI was the lawful emperor of the Romans. In this character he ascended his hereditary throne and dismissed Irene to a life of solitude and repose. But her haughty spirit condescended to the arts of dissimulation. She flattered the bishops and eunuchs, revived the filial tenderness of the prince, regained his confidence, and betrayed his credulity. The character of Constantine was not destitute of sense or spirit, but his education had been studiously neglected, and the ambitious mother exposed to the public censure the vices which she had nourished, and the actions which she had secretly advised. His divorce and second marriage offended the prejudices of the clergy, and by his imprudent rigor he forfeited the attachment of the Armenian guards. A powerful conspiracy was formed for the restoration of Irene, and the secret, though widely diffused, was faithfully kept above 8 months, till the emperor, suspicious of his danger, escaped from Constantinople with the design of appealing to the provinces and armies. By this hasty flight, the empress was left on the brink of the precipice. Yet before she implored the mercy of her son, Irene addressed a private epistle to the friends whom she had placed about his person, with a menace that unless they accomplished, she would reveal their treason. Their fear rendered them intrepid. They seized the emperor on the Asiatic shore, and he was transported to the Porphyria apartment of the palace, where he had first seen the light. In the mind of Irene, ambition had stifled every sentiment of humanity and nature, and it was decreed in her bloody council that Constantine should be rendered incapable of the throne. Her emissaries assaulted the sleeping prince and stabbed their daggers with such violence and precipitation into his eyes as if they meant to execute a mortal sentence. An ambiguous passage of Theophanes persuaded the annalist of the church that death was the immediate consequence of this barbarous execution. The Catholics have been deceived or subdued by the authority of Baronius, and Protestant zeal has re-echoed the words of a cardinal, desirous, as it should seem, to favor the patroness of images. Yet the blind son of Irene survived many years, oppressed by the court and forgotten by the world. The Isaurian dynasty was silently extinguished, and the memory of Constantine was recalled only by the nuptials of his daughter, Euphrosyne, with the Emperor Michael II. The most bigoted orthodoxy has justly execrated the unnatural mother, who may not easily be paralleled in the history of crimes. To her bloody deeds superstition has attributed a subsequent darkness of 17 days, during which many vessels in midday were driven from their course, as if the sun, a globe of fire so vast and so remote, could sympathize with the atoms of a revolving planet. On earth the crime of Irene was left 5 years unpunished. Her reign was crowned with external splendor, and if she could silence the voice of conscience, she neither heard nor regarded the reproaches of mankind. The Roman world bowed to the government of a female, and as she moved through the streets of Constantinople, the reins of 4 milk-white steeds were held by as many patricians, who marched on foot before the golden chariot of their queen. But these patricians were, for the most part, eunuchs, and their black ingratitude justified, on this occasion, the popular hatred and contempt. Raised, enriched, entrusted with the first dignities of the empire, they basely conspired against their benefactress. The great treasurer, Nicephorus, was secretly invested with the purple. Her succession was introduced into the palace and crowned at Santa Sophia by the venal patriarch. In their first interview, she recapitulated with dignity the revolutions of her life, gently accused the perfidy of Nicephorus, insinuated that he owed his life to her unsuspicious clemency, and for the throne and treasures which she resigned, solicited a decent and honorable retreat. His avarice refused this modest compensation, and in her exile of the Isle of Lesbos, the Empress earned a scanty subsistence by the labors of her distaff. Many tyrants have reigned, undoubtedly, more criminal than Nicephorus, but none perhaps have more deeply incurred the universal abhorrence of their people. His character was stained with the three odious vices of hypocrisy, ingratitude, and avarice. His want of virtue was not redeemed by any superior talents, nor his want of talents by any pleasing qualifications. Unskillful and unfortunate in war, Nicephorus was vanquished by the Saracens and slain by the Bulgarians, and the advantage of his death overbalanced in the public opinion the destruction of a Roman army. His son and heir, Stauracius, escaped from the field with a mortal wound, yet 6 months of an expiring life were sufficient to refute his indecent, though popular declaration, that he would in all things avoid the example of his father. On the near prospect of his decease, Michael, the great master of the palace and the husband of his sister Procopia, was named by every person of the palace and city, except by his envious brother. Tenacious of a scepter now falling from his hand, he conspired against the life of his successor, and cherished the idea of changing to a democracy the Roman Empire. But these rash projects served only to inflame the zeal of the people and to remove the scruples of the candidate. Michael the First accepted the purple, and before he sunk into the grave, the son of Nicephorus implored the clemency of his new sovereign. Had Michael, in an age of peace, ascended an hereditary throne, he might have reigned and died the father of his people. But his mild virtues were adapted to the shade of private life, nor was he capable of controlling the ambition of his equals or of resisting the arms of the victorious Bulgarians. While his want of ability and success exposed him to the contempt of the soldiers, the masculine spirit of his wife Procopia awakened their indignation. Even the Greeks of the 9th century were provoked by the insolence of a female who, in the front of the standards, presumed to direct their discipline and animate their valor. And their licentious clamors advised the new Semiramis to reverence the majesty of a Roman camp. After an unsuccessful campaign, the emperor left in their winter quarters of Thrace a disaffected army under the command of his enemies, and their artful eloquence persuaded the soldiers to break the dominion of the eunuchs, to degrade the husband of Procopia, and to assert the right of a military election. They marched towards the capital, yet the clergy, the senate, and the people of Constantinople adhered to the cause of Michael, and the troops and treasures of Asia might have protracted the mischiefs of civil war. But his humanity, by the ambitious it will be termed his weakness, protested that not a drop of Christian blood should be shed in his quarrel, and his messengers presented the conquerors with the keys of the city and the palace. They were disarmed by his innocence and submission. His life and his eyes were spared, and the imperial monk enjoyed the comforts of solitude and religion above 32 years after he had been stripped of the purple and separated from his wife. A rebel in the time of Nicephorus, the famous and unfortunate Bardanes, had once the curiosity to consult an Asiatic prophet, who, after prognosticating his fall, announced the fortunes of his 3 principal officers— Leo the Armenian, Michael the Phrygian, and Thomas the Cappadocian. The successive reigns of the 2 former, the fruitless and fatal enterprise of the 3rd. This prediction was verified, or rather was produced, by the event. 10 years afterwards, when the Thracian camp rejected the husband of Procopia, the crown was presented to the same Leo, the first in military rank and the secret author of the mutiny. As he affected to hesitate, "With this sword," said his companion Michael, "I will open the gates of Constantinople to your imperial sway, or instantly plunge it into your bosom if you obstinately resist the just desires of your fellow soldiers." The compliance of the Armenian was rewarded with the empire, and he reigned 7 years and a half under the name of Leo V. Educated in a camp and ignorant both of laws and letters, he introduced into his civil government the rigor and even cruelty of military discipline. But if his severity was sometimes dangerous to the innocent, it was always formidable to the guilty. His religious inconstancy was taxed by the epithet of chameleon, but the Catholics have acknowledged by the voice of a saint and confessors that the life of the iconoclast was useful to the Republic. The zeal of his companion Michael was repaid with riches, honors, and military command, and his subordinate talents were beneficially employed in the public service. Yet the Phrygian was dissatisfied at receiving, as a favor, a scanty portion of the imperial prize which he had bestowed on his equal, and his discontent, which sometimes evaporated in hasty discourse, at length assumed a more threatening and hostile aspect against a prince whom he represented as a cruel tyrant. That tyrant, however, repeatedly detected, warned, and dismissed the old companion of his arms, till fear and resentment prevailed over gratitude, and Michael, after a scrutiny into his actions and designs, was convicted of treason and sentenced to be burnt alive in the furnace of the private baths. The devout humanity of the Empress Theophano was fatal to her husband and family. A solemn day, the 25th of December, had been fixed for the execution. She urged that the anniversary of the Saviour's birth would be profaned by this inhuman spectacle, and Leo consented with reluctance to a decent respite. But on the vigil of the feast, his sleepless anxiety prompted him to visit at the dead of night the chamber in which his enemy was confined. He beheld him released from his chain, and stretched on his jailer's bed in a profound slumber. Leo was alarmed at these signs of security and intelligence, but though he retired with silent steps, his entrance and departure were noticed by a slave who lay concealed in a corner of the prison. Under the pretense of requesting the spiritual aid of a confessor, Michael informed the conspirators that their lives depended on his discretion, and that a few hours were left to assure their own safety by the deliverance of their friend and country. On the great festivals, a chosen band of priests and chanters was admitted into the palace by a private gate to sing matins in the chapel, and Leo, who regulated with the same strictness the discipline of the choir and of the camp, was seldom absent from these early devotions. In the ecclesiastical habit, but with their swords under their robes, the conspirators mingled with the procession, lurked in the angles of the chapel, and expected as the signal of murder the intonation of the first psalm by the emperor himself. The imperfect light and the uniformity of dress might have favored his escape, whilst their assault was pointed against a harmless priest. But they soon discovered their mistake and encompassed on all sides the royal victim. Without a weapon and without a friend, he grasped a weighty cross and stood at bay against the hunters of his life. But as he asked for mercy, "This is the hour not of mercy, but of vengeance," was the inexorable reply. The stroke of a well-aimed sword separated from his body the right arm and the cross, and Leo the Armenian was slain at the foot of the altar. A memorable reverse of fortune was displayed in Michael II, who from a defect in his speech was surnamed the Stammerer. He was snatched from the fiery furnace to the sovereignty of an empire. And as in the tumult a smith could not readily be found, the fetters remained on his legs several hours after he was seated on the throne of the Caesars. The royal blood which had been the price of his elevation was unprofitably spent. In the purple he retained the ignoble vices of his origin, and Michael lost his provinces with as supine indifference as if they had been the inheritance of his fathers. His title was disputed by Thomas, the last of the military triumvirate, who transported into Europe 80,000 barbarians from the banks of the Tigris and the shores of the Caspian. He formed the siege of Constantinople, but the capital was defended with spiritual and carnal weapons. A Bulgarian king assaulted the camp of the Orientals, and Thomas had the misfortune, or the weakness, to fall alive into the power of the conqueror. The hands and feet of the rebel were amputated. He was placed on an ass, and amidst the insults of the people, was led through the streets, which he sprinkled with his blood. The deprivation of manners, as savage as they were corrupt, is marked by the presence of the emperor himself. Deaf to the lamentation of a fellow soldier, he incessantly pressed the discovery of more accomplices, till his curiosity was checked by the question of an honest or guilty minister. "Would you give credit to an enemy against the most faithful of your friends?" After the death of his first wife, the emperor, at the request of the Senate, drew from her monastery Euphrosyne, the daughter of Constantine VI. Her august birth might justify a stipulation in the marriage contract that her children should equally share the empire with their elder brother. But the nuptials of Michael and Euphrosyne were barren, and she was content with the title of Mother of Theophilus, his son and successor. The character of Theophilus is a rare example in which religious zeal has allowed, and perhaps magnified, the virtues of a heretic and a persecutor. His valor was often felt by the enemies, and his justice by the subjects of the monarchy. But the valor of Theophilus was rash and fruitless, and his justice arbitrary and cruel. He displayed the banner of the cross against the Saracens, but his 5 expeditions were concluded by a signal overthrow. Amorium, the native city of his ancestors, was levelled with the ground, and from his military toils he derived only the surname of the Unfortunate. The wisdom of a sovereign is comprised in the institution of laws and the choice of magistrates, and while he seems without action, his civil government revolves round his centre with the silence and order of the planetary system. But the justice of Theophilus was fashioned on the model of the Oriental despots, who in personal and irregular acts of authority consult the reason or passion of the moment, without measuring the sentence by the law or the penalty by the offence. A poor woman threw herself at the emperor's feet to complain of a powerful neighbor, the brother of the empress, who had raised his palace wall to such an inconvenient height that her humble dwelling was excluded from light and air. On the proof of the fact, instead of granting, like an ordinary judge, sufficient or ample damages to the plaintiff, the sovereign adjudged to her use and benefit the palace and the ground. Nor was Theophilus content with this extravagant satisfaction. His zeal converted a civil trespass into a criminal act, and the unfortunate patrician was stripped and scourged in the public place of Constantinople. For some venial offences, some defect of equity or vigilance, the principal ministers, a prefect, a quaestor, a captain of the guards, were banished or mutilated or scalded with boiling pitch or burnt alive in the hippodrome. And as these dreadful examples might be the effects of error or caprice, they must have alienated from his service the best and wisest of the citizens. But the pride of the monarch was flattered in the exercise of power, or, as he thought, of virtue, and the people, safe in their obscurity, applauded the danger and debasement of their superiors. This extraordinary rigor was justified, in some measure, by its salutary consequences, since after a scrutiny of 17 days not a complaint or abuse could be found in the court or city, and it might be alleged that the Greeks could be ruled only with a rod of iron, and that the public interest is the motive and law of the supreme judge. Yet in the crime or the suspicion of treason, that judge is, of all others, the most credulous and partial. Theophilus might inflict a tardy vengeance on the assassins of Leo and the saviors of his father, but he enjoyed the fruits of their crime, and his jealous tyranny sacrificed a brother and a prince to the future safety of his life. A Persian of the race of the Sassanides died in poverty and exile at Constantinople, leaving an only son, the issue of a plebeian marriage. At the age of 12 years, the royal birth of Theophobus was revealed, and his merit was not unworthy of his birth. He was educated in the Byzantine palace, a Christian and a soldier, advanced with rapid steps in the career of fortune and glory, received the hand of the emperor's sister, and was promoted to the command of 30,000 Persians, who, like his father, had fled from the Mohammedan conquerors. These troops, doubly infected with mercenary and fanatic vices, were desirous of revolting against their benefactor and erecting the standard of their native king. But the loyal Theophobus rejected their offers, disconcerted their schemes, and escaped from their hands to the camp or palace of his royal brother. A generous confidence might have secured a faithful and able guardian for his wife and his infant son, to whom Theophobus, in the flower of his age, was compelled to leave the inheritance of the empire. But his jealousy was exasperated by envy and disease. He feared the dangerous virtues which might either support or oppress their infancy and weakness, and the dying emperor demanded the head of the Persian prince. With savage delight he recognized the familiar features of his brother. "Thou art no longer Theophobus," he said. And sinking on his couch, he added with a faltering voice, "Soon, too soon, I shall be no more Theophilus." The Russians, who have borrowed from the Greeks the greatest part of their civil and ecclesiastical policy, preserved, till the last century, a singular institution in the marriage of the Tsar. They collected not the virgins of every rank and every province, a vain and romantic idea, but the daughters of the principal nobles, who awaited in the palace the choice of their sovereign. It is affirmed that a similar method was adopted in the nuptials of Theophilus. With a golden apple in his hand, he slowly walked between two lines of contending beauties. His eye was detained by the charms of Icasia, and in the awkwardness of a first declaration, the prince could only observe that in this world women had been the cause of much evil. "And surely, sir," she pertly replied, "they have likewise been the occasion of much good." This affectation of unseasonable wit displeased the imperial lover. He turned aside in disgust. Icasia concealed her mortification in a convent, and the modest silence of Theodora was rewarded with the golden apple. She deserved the love, but did not escape the severity of her lord. From the palace garden he beheld a vessel deeply laden and steering into the port, on the discovery that the precious cargo of Syrian luxury was the property of his wife, he condemned the ship to the flames, with a sharp reproach that her avarice had degraded the character of an empress into that of a merchant. Yet his last choice entrusted her with the guardianship of the empire, and her son Michael, who was left an orphan in the 5th year of his age. The restoration of images and the final extirpation of the iconoclasts has endeared her name to the devotion of the Greeks. But in the fervor of religious zeal, Theodora entertained a grateful regard for the memory and salvation of her husband. After 13 years of a prudent and frugal administration, she perceived the decline of her influence. But the second Irene imitated only the virtues of her predecessor. Instead of conspiring against the life or government of her son, she retired without a struggle, though not without a murmur, to the solitude of private life, deploring the ingratitude, the vices, and the inevitable ruin of the worthless youth. Among the successors of Nero and Elagabalus, we have not hitherto found the imitation of their vices. The character of a Roman prince who considered pleasure as the object of life and virtue as the enemy of pleasure. Whatever might have been the maternal care of Theodora in the education of Michael III, her unfortunate son was a king before he was a man. If the ambitious mother labored to check the progress of reason, she could not cool the ebullition of passion. And her selfish policy was justly repaid by the contempt and ingratitude of the headstrong youth. At the age of 18 he rejected her authority, without feeling his own incapacity to govern the empire and himself. With Theodora, all gravity and wisdom retired from the court. Their place was supplied by the alternate dominion of vice and folly, and it was impossible, without forfeiting the public esteem, to acquire or preserve the favor of the emperor. The millions of gold and silver which had been accumulated for the service of the state were lavished on the vilest of men who flattered his passions and shared his pleasures. And in a reign of 13 years the richest of sovereigns was compelled to strip the palace and the churches of their precious furniture. Like Nero, he delighted in the amusements of the theatre and sighed to be surpassed in the accomplishments in which he should have blushed to excel. Yet the studies of Nero in music and poetry betrayed some symptoms of a liberal taste. The more ignoble arts of the son of Theophilus were confined to the chariot race of the Hippodrome. The four factions which had agitated the peace still amused the idleness of the capital. For himself the emperor assumed the blue livery, the three rival colors were distributed to his favorites, and in the vile though eager contention he forgot the dignity of his person and the safety of his dominions. He silenced the messenger of an invasion who presumed to divert his attention in the most critical moment of the race, and by his command the importunate beacons were extinguished that too frequently spread the alarm from Tarsus to Constantinople. The most skillful charioteers obtained the first place in his confidence and esteem. Their merit was profusely rewarded. The emperor feasted in their houses and presented their children at the baptismal font. And while he applauded his own popularity, he affected to blame the cold and stately reserve of his predecessors. The unnatural lusts which had degraded even the manhood of Nero were banished from the world. Yet the strength of Michael was consumed by the indulgence of love and intemperance. In his midnight revels, when his passions were inflamed by wine, he was provoked to issue the most sanguinary commands, and if any feelings of humanity were left, he was reduced, with the return of sense, to approve the salutary disobedience of his servants. But the most extraordinary feature in the character of Michael is the profane mockery of the religion of his country. The superstition of the Greeks might indeed excite the smile of a philosopher, but his smile would have been rational and temperate, and he must have condemned the ignorant folly of a youth who insulted the objects of public veneration. A buffoon of the court was invested in the robes of the patriarch. His 12 metropolitans, among whom the emperor was ranked, assumed their ecclesiastical garments. They used or abused the sacred vessels of the altar, and in their bacchanalian feasts, the Holy Communion was administered in a nauseous compound of vinegar and mustard. Nor were these impious spectacles concealed from the eyes of the city. On the day of a solemn festival, the emperor, with his bishops, or buffoons, rode on asses through the streets, encountered the true patriarch at the head of his clergy, and by their licentious shouts and obscene gestures, disordered the gravity of the Christian procession. The devotion of Michael appeared only in some offence to reason or piety. He received his theatrical crowns from the statue of the Virgin, and an imperial tomb was violated for the sake of burning the bones of Constantine the Iconoclast. By this extravagant conduct, the son of Theophilus became as contemptible as he was odious. Every citizen was impatient for the deliverance of his country, and even the favorites of the moment were apprehensive that a caprice might snatch away what a caprice had bestowed. In the 13th year of his age, and in the hour of intoxication and sleep, Michael III was murdered in his chamber by the founder of a new dynasty, whom the emperor had raised to an equality of rank and power. The genealogy of Basil the Macedonian, if it be not the spurious offspring of pride and flattery, exhibits a genuine picture of the revolution of the most illustrious families. The Arsacides, the rivals of Rome, possessed the scepter of the East near 400 years. A younger branch of these Parthian kings continued to reign in Armenia, but their royal descendants survived the partition and servitude of that ancient monarchy. Two of these, Artabanus and Cleinias, escaped or retired to the court of Leo I. His bounty seated them in a safe and hospitable exile in the province of Macedonia. Adrianople was their final settlement. During several generations they maintained the dignity of their birth, and their Roman patriotism rejected the tempting offers of the Persian and Arabian powers, who recalled them to their native country. But their splendor was insensibly clouded by time and poverty, and the father of Basil was reduced to a small farm, which he cultivated with his own hands. Yet he scorned to disgrace the blood of the Arsacides by a plebeian alliance. His wife, a widow of Adrianople, was pleased to count among her ancestors the great Constantine, and their royal infant was connected by some dark affinity of lineage or country with the Macedonian Alexander. No sooner was he born than the cradle of Basil, his family, and his city were swept away by an inundation of the Bulgarians. He was educated a slave in a foreign land, and in this severe discipline he acquired the hardiness of body and flexibility of mind, which promoted his future elevation. In the age of youth or manhood he shared the deliverance of the Roman captives, who generously broke their fetters, marched through Bulgaria to the shores of the Black Sea, defeated two armies of barbarians, embarked in the ships which had been stationed for their reception, and returned to Constantinople, from whence they were distributed to their respective homes. But the freedom of Basil was naked and destitute. His farm was ruined by the calamities of war. After his father's death, his manual labor or service could no longer support a family of orphans, and he resolved to seek a more conspicuous theater, in which every virtue and every vice may lead to the paths of greatness. The first night of his arrival at Constantinople, without friends or money, the weary pilgrim slept on the steps of the church of St. Diomede. He was fed by the casual hospitality of a monk, and was introduced to the service of a cousin and namesake of the Emperor Theophilus, who, though himself of a diminutive person, was always followed by a train of tall and handsome domestics. Basil attended his patron to the government of Peloponnesus. Eclipsed by his personal merit the birth and dignity of Theophilus, and formed a useful connection with a wealthy and charitable matron of Patras. Her spiritual or carnal love embraced the young adventurer, whom she adopted as her son. Danielis presented him with 30 slaves, and the produce of her bounty was expended in the support of his brothers and the purchase of some large estates in Macedonia. His gratitude or ambition still attached him to the service of Theophilus, and a lucky accident recommended him to the notice of the court. A famous wrestler in the train of the Bulgarian ambassadors had defied at the royal banquet the boldest and most robust of the Greeks. the strength of Basil was praised. He accepted the challenge, and the barbarian champion was overthrown at the first onset. A beautiful but vicious horse was condemned to be hamstrung. It was subdued by the dexterity and courage of the servant of Theophilus, and his conqueror was promoted to an honorable rank in the imperial stables. But it was impossible to obtain the confidence of Michael without complying with his vices, and his new favorite, the great chamberlain of the palace, was raised and supported by a disgraceful marriage with a royal concubine, and the dishonor of his sister, who succeeded to her place. The public administration had been abandoned to the Caesar Bardas, the brother and enemy of Theodora, but the arts of female influence persuaded Michael to hate and to fear his uncle. He was drawn from Constantinople under the pretense of a Cretan expedition, and stabbed in the tent of audience by the sword of the chamberlain, and in the presence of the emperor. About a month after this execution, Basil was invested with the title of Augustus and the government of the empire. He supported this unequal association till his influence was fortified by popular esteem. His life was endangered by the caprice of the emperor, and his dignity was profaned by a second colleague who had rowed in the galleys. Yet the murder of his benefactor must be condemned as an act of ingratitude and treason. And the churches which he dedicated to the name of Saint Michael were a poor and puerile expiation of his guilt. The different ages of Basil I may be compared with those of Augustus. The situation of the Greek did not allow him in his earliest youth to lead an army against his country, or to proscribe the nobles of her sons. But his aspiring genius stooped to the arts of a slave. He dissembled his ambition and even his virtues, and grasped with the bloody hand of an assassin the empire which he ruled with the wisdom and tenderness of a parent. A private citizen may feel his interest repugnant to his duty, but it must be from a deficiency of sense or courage that an absolute monarch can separate his happiness from his glory, or his glory from the public welfare. The life, or panegyric, of Basil has indeed been composed and published under the long reign of his descendants, but even their stability on the throne may be justly ascribed to the superior merit of their ancestor. In his character, his grandson Constantine has attempted to delineate a perfect image of royalty, but that feeble prince, unless he had copied a real model, could not easily have soared so high above the level of his own conduct or conceptions. But the most solid praise of Basil is drawn from the comparison of a ruined and a flourishing monarchy, that which he wrested from the dissolute Michael, and that which he bequeathed to the Macedonian dynasty. The evils which had been sanctified by time and example were corrected by his master hand, and he revived, if not the national spirit, at least the order and majesty of the Roman Empire. His application was indefatigable, his temper cool, his understanding vigorous and decisive, and in his practice he observed that rare and salutary moderation which pursues each virtue at an equal distance between the opposite vices. His military service has been confined to the palace, nor was the emperor endowed with the spirit or the talents of a warrior. Yet under his reign the Roman arms were again formidable to the barbarians. As soon as he had formed a new army by discipline and exercise, he appeared in person on the banks of the Euphrates, curbed the pride of the Saracens, and suppressed the dangerous, though just, revolt of the Manichaeans. His indignation against a rebel who had long eluded his pursuit provoked him to wish and to pray that by the grace of God he might drive three arrows into the head of Chrysocheir. That odious head, which had been obtained by treason rather than by valor, was suspended from a tree, and thrice exposed to the dexterity of the imperial archer. A base revenge against the dead, more worthy of the times than of the character of Basil. But his principal merit was in the civil administration of the finances and of the laws. to replenish an exhausted treasury, it was proposed to resume the lavish and ill-placed gifts of his predecessor. His prudence abated one moiety of the restitution, and a sum of £1,200 was instantly procured to answer the most pressing demands and to allow some space for the mature operations of economy. Among the various schemes for the improvement of the revenue, a new mode was suggested of capitation, or tribute, which would have too much depended on the arbitrary discretion of the assessors. A sufficient list of honest and able agents was instantly produced by the minister, but on the more careful scrutiny of Basil himself, only two could be found who might be safely entrusted with such dangerous powers, but they justified his esteem by declining his confidence. But the serious and successful diligence of the emperor established by degrees the equitable balance of property and payment, of receipt and expenditure. A peculiar fund was appropriated to each service, and a public method secured the interest of the prince and the property of the people. After reforming the luxury, he assigned two patrimonial estates to supply the decent plenty of the imperial table. The contributions of the subject were reserved for his defense, and the residue was employed in the embellishment of the capital and provinces. A taste for building, however costly, may deserve some praise and much excuse. From thence industry is fed, art is encouraged, and some object is attained of public emolument or pleasure. The use of a road, an aqueduct, or a hospital is obvious and solid, and the 100 churches that arose by the command of Basil were consecrated to the devotion of the age. In the character of a judge he was assiduous and impartial, desirous to save, but not afraid to strike. The oppressors of the people were severely chastised, but his personal foes, whom it might be unsafe to pardon, were condemned, after the loss of their eyes, to a life of solitude and repentance. The change of language and manners demanded a revision of the obsolete jurisprudence of Justinian. The voluminous body of his institutes, pandects, code, and novels was digested under 40 titles in the Greek idiom. And the basilics, which were improved and completed by his son and grandson, must be referred to the original genius of the founder of their race. This glorious reign was terminated by an accident in the chase. A furious stag entangled his horns in the belt of Basil and raised him from his horse. He was rescued by an attendant who cut the belt and slew the animal. But the fall, or the fever, exhausted the strength of the aged monarch, and he expired in the palace amidst the tears of his family and people. If he struck off the head of the faithful servant for presuming to draw his sword against his sovereign, the pride of despotism which had lain dormant in his life revived in the last moments of despair, when he no longer wanted or valued the opinion of mankind. Of the four sons of the emperor, Constantine died before his father, whose grief and credulity were amused by a flattering impostor and a vain apparition. Stephen, the youngest, was content with the honors of a patriarch and a saint. Both Leo and Alexander were alike invested with the purple, but the powers of government were solely exercised by the elder brother. The name of Leo VI has been dignified with the title of philosopher, and the union of the prince and the sage, of the active and speculative virtues, would indeed constitute the perfection of human nature. But the claims of Leo are far short of this ideal excellence. Did he reduce his passions and appetites under the dominion of reason? His life was spent in the pomp of the palace, in the society of his wives and concubines, and even the clemency which he showed and the peace which he strove to preserve must be imputed to the softness and indolence of his character. Did he subdue his prejudices and those of his subjects? His mind was tinged with the most puerile superstition. The influence of the clergy and the errors of the people were consecrated by his laws, and the oracles of Leo, which reveal in prophetic style the fates of the empire, are founded on the arts of astrology and divination. If we still inquire the reason of his sage appellation, it can only be replied that the son of Basil was less ignorant than the greater part of his contemporaries in church and state, that his education had been directed by the learned Photius, and that several books of profane and ecclesiastical science were composed by the pen, or in the name of the imperial philosopher. But the reputation of his philosophy and religion was overthrown by domestic vice, the repetition of his nuptials. The primitive ideas of the merit and holiness of celibacy were preached by the monks and entertained by the Greeks. Marriage was allowed as a necessary means for the propagation of mankind. After the death of either party, the survivor might satisfy, by second union, the weakness or the strength of the flesh. But a third marriage was censured as a state of legal fornication, and a fourth was a sin or a scandal as yet unknown to the Christians of the East. In the beginning of his reign, Leo himself had abolished the state of concubines, and condemned, without annulling, third marriages. But his patriotism and love soon compelled him to violate his own laws, and to incur the penance, which in a similar case he had imposed on his subjects. In his first three alliances, his nuptial bed was unfruitful. The emperor required a female companion, and the empire a legitimate heir. The beautiful Zoe was introduced into the palace as a concubine, and after a trial of her fecundity and the birth of Constantine, her lover declared his intention of legitimating the mother and the child by the celebration of his fourth nuptials. But the patriarch Nicholas refused his blessing. The imperial baptism of the young prince was obtained by a promise of separation, and the contumacious husband of Zoe was excluded from the communion of the faithful. Neither the fear of exile, nor the desertion of his brethren, nor the authority of the Latin Church, nor the danger of failure or doubt in the succession to the empire, could bend the spirit of the inflexible monk. After the death of Leo, he was recalled from exile to the civil and ecclesiastical administration, and the Edict of Union, which was promulgated in the name of Constantine, condemned the future scandal of fourth marriages and left a tacit imputation on his own birth. In the Greek language, purple and porphyry are the same word, and as the colors of nature are invariable, we may learn that a dark, deep red was the Tyrian dye which stained the purple of the ancients. An apartment of the Byzantine palace was lined with porphyry. It was reserved for the use of the pregnant empresses. Then the royal birth of their children was expressed by the appellation of porphyrogenite, or born in the purple. Several of the Roman princes had been blessed with an heir, but this peculiar surname was first applied to Constantine the Seventh. His life and titular reign were of equal duration, but of 54 years, 6 had elapsed before his father's death, and the son of Leo was ever the voluntary or reluctant subject of those who oppressed his weakness or abused his confidence. His uncle Alexander, who had long been invested with the title of Augustus, was the first colleague and governor of the young prince. But in a rapid career of vice and folly, the brother of Leo already emulated the reputation of Michael, and when he was extinguished by a timely death, he entertained a project of castrating his nephew and leaving the empire to a worthless favorite. The succeeding years of the minority of Constantine were occupied by his mother Zoe and a succession or council of 7 regents, who pursued their interest, gratified their passions, abandoned the republic, supplanted each other, and finally vanished in the